You're listening to After the Storm, where the healing begins on UK Health Radio. I'm Brian D. Smith, founder of Grief to Growth and a certified grief guide, life coach, and author. This part of my journey began after the passing of my 15-year-old daughter, Shayna. So I'm doing the work too. Each week, we explore the journey through grief, not just surviving loss, but discovering who you're becoming on the other side of it. This is where the healing begins. Before I get into the heart of today's episode, I want to make a little disclaimer or explanation, I guess is a better word. This is the second time I'm recording this episode. It's full of a lot of evidence. We're going to refer to last week where I set up why we need the evidence. I told you I'd bring the receipts. But the thing is, when I started recording this, it started sounding like I was reading to you a scientific paper with a lot of numbers and percentages, and that just doesn't play right on a radio program. So what I'm going to do as a special thing today for this episode is there will be a companion article. So if you go to my Substack, grieftogrowth.com/substack, grieftogrowth.com/substack, and search for After the Storm Episode 9, you'll find the companion article. Now, the difference in the article will be it's going to include all the receipts. I've told you I'm not going to ask you to believe things without evidence. I want to present the evidence, but frankly, it gets really boring when I'm just reading it to you over the air. So take that to heart. If you want to go check out the evidence, it's going to be there for you. So now on with the show. In a hospital in Swansea, South Wales, a nurse spent years asking her patients one question. Not a clever question, not a leading question. She asked them, "Do you have any recollection of anything during the time that you were unconscious, the time that you were out, maybe even the time that they were dead?" Most said no. Some described dreams, some described hallucinations, and she wrote all of it down because she wanted the comparison. Now, a small number of them described the room, the equipment, the people, what was said, what was done to them while they were, by every measure available to medicine, not there, unconscious or dead. Her name is Penny Sartori, and I'm going to come back to her because she did something that almost nobody in this field does. She drew the blood, and I'll tell you what that means later. Last week, I told you I spent 30 years looking at the evidence about what's behind the door that comes at the end of our physical life, the door that we're all approaching as we come to that end. And I told you where I landed. I didn't necessarily tell you why. Well, that's today. Welcome to After the Storm. Last week, we talked about what amount of evidence it would take to conclude there's something after our physical life. And we talked about the fact that proof belongs only to mathematics and logic. If you're looking for absolute proof, that's not going to happen. That doesn't happen in science. Science runs on the preponderance of the evidence. And we talked about the courtroom standard. Beyond a reasonable doubt. In a capital case, anyone whose mind is already shut isn't allowed on that jury. So what I asked you last week was to keep an open mind, and that's the standard I hold myself to today, and you should hold me to it too. So again, just in review, I am not here to, quote, prove anything because it is impossible to prove it. And anyone who tells you they have proof in either direction that there is a life after death or that there isn't is actually not being truthful with you. But what I do have is this. I have five separate bodies of evidence, five streams that form a river. Not one of them settles it. I want to be clear about that from the very top. If you take any of these streams I'm going to present to you on their own, a reasonable person could walk away unconvinced. And frankly, I wouldn't think any less of them for it. But what interests me is that these five streams are independent. Different researchers, different countries, different decades, different methods. People who in many cases have never read each other's work. Last week, I used the analogy of a rope versus a chain. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. A rope is made of many fibers. If one fiber breaks, the rope still holds. That's the analogy I want you to carry through the rest of these streams that I'm going to talk about, are these fibers. I'm mixing analogies here. These fibers that make up the rope are these streams that make up the river. But before that, there's a question of who's actually on trial here. And I don't think it's been asked fairly. Before we get into it, a bit of a trigger warning. We're going to talk about some things like cardiac arrest, dementia, and the passing of children. Nothing graphic at all. But I know if you're in a deep state of grief, you might be activated by these things. And it's okay to come back to this one later. I just wanted to let you know that up front. There is this extraordinary claims issue. Before I show you a single piece of evidence, I really want to talk about the scoreboard. That phrase, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I've heard people I highly respect say that. And I don't have a problem with the phrase. My problem is who gets to decide which claim is the extraordinary one. And I'm going to explain to you why I think that. In most rooms for the last couple of hundred years, materialism has been treated as the resting position, the default, the one that we have to disprove. What a sensible person believes until somebody drags them off of it has been taught to be materialism. But I want you to know that's only been true for a couple of hundred years. Before that, the vast majority of people believed in survival after physical death. That was the default position. But what happens now is survival is treated as the claim on trial, the one that owes everybody an explanation. And frankly, nobody voted on that arrangement. It was assigned. So what is a genuinely neutral position? The one before anybody puts a thumb on the scale? Well, it's not materialism. Here's what we actually observe. We observe consciousness, the fact that there's something it's like to be you, sitting there right now listening to this. That's consciousness. And we observe brains, physical objects. We can cut, we can weigh, we can scan them, and we observe a strong, reliable correlation between the two. If you damage the brain, consciousness changes. If you put someone under anesthesia, consciousness goes away temporarily. Nobody disputes that correlation. And that correlation has gotten us some great science and some great medicine. But what's in question is what the correlation means. I say that there are at least two hypotheses that both fit the data. I think three. One hypothesis is that the brain produces consciousness, the way the stomach produces digestion. That's kind of the default standard right now of materialism. But two, and you may not have heard this one, is that the brain mediates consciousness. Consciousness comes through the brain rather than from it. I like the analogy of a radio receiver. If you damage that receiver, you lose the signal, but that doesn't mean the signal is gone. Another version of the same idea that the brain mediates consciousness is the brain is a filter, that we're actually a greater consciousness that our brain filters down into our body. And both of these hypotheses work, or all three of these hypotheses actually work. And there's evidence to back up all three of them. And this isn't some new age idea we made up. William James raised it back in 1898, and he called it the transmissive function. He said plainly that the production theory, being that the brain produces consciousness, was an assumption. It's not a finding. And I want you to really sit with that for a second, because most of us have been taught that the production theory is just obvious, but it's really not. Both of these things are claims. Both carry a burden. Neither one gets to sit in the chair marked default and make the other side do all the work. Now, let me be fair to the other side. Neuroscience has been extraordinary at solving what philosophers call the easy problems. Which regions activate in the brain when certain things happen, how memory encodes, how a nerve signal propagates through the brain through electricity. Real work, real medicine, real lives saved. I'm not sneering at any of that. As you know, I'm an engineer, I'm a scientist. But what has never been produced is any account of why all of that is accompanied by any experience at all. This is so fundamental to us that it's hard to see how strange it is. The fact that you experience the color you're looking at is red. The fact that a grape tastes like a grape to you. Now, we know the mechanism. Molecules touch your tongue. Signals travel to your brain. But what we don't know is why any of that is actually experienced by anyone. This has a name. It's called qualia. The quality of an experience from the inside. Q-U-A-L-I-A, in case you haven't heard of the word. And the puzzle around this is called the hard problem of consciousness. Why we have any experience at all? Why we experience red as red, or the taste of a grape as a taste of a grape? The heart problem of consciousness is actually a term used by mainstream philosophers and neuroscientists. It's not by mystics. It's not from the people outside. It's from the people inside. And that tells you that the problem is acknowledged by the very people who most like it to go away. There's a thought experiment here I like. Imagine a scientist who spent her whole life in a black and white room. She's learned everything physical there is to know about color. She knows about wavelengths of light. She knows about pathways of the brain and the neurons from the eye to the brain. She knows all the processes, but she's never seen the color red. She's lived in a black and white room. One day, she walks outside and she sees a red apple. Does she learn something new? If she does, then the physical facts weren't all the facts. She now knows the experience of the color red, not just the mechanism. And that is what we don't understand, why we have that experience of the color red, even though we do understand the mechanism. That's the shape of the problem. In engineering, we don't get to assert a mechanism we can't specify. If someone tells you a process produces an output, you're entitled to ask how. Show me the step. On consciousness, there is no step. There's no step from the mechanism to the experience. Now, there's a correlation, and there's an assertion laid on top of it, and there's a great deal of confidence, but the mechanism has never been shown. So when I'm told that my claim that we go on beyond the physical life is the extraordinary one, here's what I want to say back. I have a claim with evidence, and I'm going to give you the evidence today. And I don't have a mechanism for it, though. I don't know how consciousness goes on beyond physical life. The other side says that consciousness is produced by the brain, and it calls itself a default, but it can't explain why the mechanism leads to the experience. I'm not asking you to accept my conclusion, but what I'm asking you is this, to make sure that both sides show up to court. And that's what the next while is going to be about. I'm going to put evidence in front of you because I think it's what you owe people when you make a claim. The first stream is near-death experiences. Now, near-death experiences are easy to dismiss on their face, and the dismissals are reasonable on the surface. Oxygen starvation, drugs, a dying brain misfiring, wishful thinking, memory constructed after the fact to fill the gap. Every one of these is a real hypothesis and deserves testing. What you may not know is they've been tested. And see, the honest thing, though, is most NDE research has never actually tested them because most of this is what we call retrospective. Someone has an experience, and years later, a researcher interviews them. And retrospective research can't get down to the details of what happened during the time. You need someone standing there at the time, which brings us back to Swansea that I mentioned in the very beginning.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Penny Sartori worked as an intensive care nurse at Morriston Hospital. She's not a philosopher who wandered in. She is the person doing the resuscitating. Her study was prospective or prospective, meaning she collected the data as it happened. She didn't reconstruct it later through interviews. She was later awarded a PhD for it, supervised by Peter Fenwick and Paul Badham. Her stated aim, in her own words, was to find out whether the reductionist explanations, the drugs, the low oxygen, could actually account for what patients were reporting. She wasn't trying to prove survival. She was trying to test these explanations. And here's what she found. Among patients who survived intensive care without coming especially close to death, almost none of them reported anything like this. They did not report NDE-like experiences. Among patients who suffered cardiac arrest, who've been clinically dead for a period of time, a real and notable share of them did. And the closer to death they were, the more likely they were to have this experience that we call the near-death experience. Now, here's a detail that really got me. She compared heart rhythms among the cardiac arrest survivors. The rhythm most common among those reporting the experience was asystole, the flat line. That's the rhythm with the highest fatality rate of any of them. The deeper into death the patient went, the more likely they were to come back with something to report. This is why we call it a near-death experience. So let's talk about the drugs. Almost all of Penny's patients were on painkillers and sedatives. That's what happens when you're in intensive care. So if the drugs cause these experiences, you'd expect the flood of these experiences from a lot of the patients in intensive care, regardless of how close they got to death. Now, she found the opposite. She documented cases where an experience became confused after painkillers were administered, and one patient who could no longer recall an experience he'd already described to visitors after a further round of sedation. Her conclusion, and this is the one I think matters, the drugs appeared to inhibit these experiences rather than cause them. And then back to the blood I talked about earlier, the drawing of the blood. This is a part that almost nobody else had. Penny had arterial blood drawn at the time of the emergency, while the experience was happening. The blood chemistry did not support the low oxygen explanation. The two most commonly offered physical explanations for these experiences were tested against the patient's own blood at the bedside in real time, and they did not hold up. She also compared these accounts to actual hallucinations. She documented those too in patients in the same unit. The hallucinations were random, bizarre, and tangled up with whatever was happening in the room. The near-death accounts followed a clear, consistent pattern instead. So they weren't confused, and they weren't really necessarily tangled up with what was happening in the room. And on follow-up, the difference held. The people who had hallucinated could recognize afterward that they had been hallucinating, and they said this was an hallucination. The people with near-death accounts remained adamant that what happened to them was real. There was a difference between the people who hallucinated and the people who said they had a near-death experience. And she ran one more comparison I'd love to hand to a skeptic. She took patients who'd been resuscitated but reported nothing, and she asked them to report their own resuscitation, to describe what was done to them. And of course, they got it wrong consistently. The wrong equipment, the wrong procedures, guesses based upon what they'd seen on TV. So the theory that people just reconstruct a plausible medical scene from cultural knowledge has actually been tested. And when people try to do that, it looks nothing like an accurate account. It looks like guessing. The opposite is the people who said they'd had an experience, when they were asked to recount what happened while they were out, they described the room with real accuracy. So I want to be honest about one test that actually didn't go Penny's way. She placed symbols on top of the cardiac monitors that were visible only from above. The thing is, thinking anyone who had left their body and looked down should have seen these symbols and been able to report them. And nobody did. So as far as I know, that test has not yielded results, and it's been done more than once. And one more finding, the one I want the nurses and the doctors who are listening to hear, in case you're one of them. In Penny's study, the overwhelming majority of these experiences were never mentioned to staff, unless they were specifically asked of the patients. So I want to say to you this, your patients are having these experiences. They're just not telling you because they've learned it isn't safe to. They only report it when Penny asks them. Some people have actually been sent to psych wards for reporting these experiences, so people keep them to themselves. If you work in critical care, hospice, or dementia ward, you're in a position to just ask the question. It costs nothing, and it changes what the patient has to carry. Now, her sample was small. She said so herself in print before any critic could say it for her. There's not a lot of money for this type of research. There's not a lot of money put into trying to prove survival after death. So that's what an honest researcher says. This is Penny saying, you know, this is not a verdict. This is one stream. But it does answer a lot of the, it's just a dying brain objections. And a lot more of that is in Penny's book, which I've read and I recommend. So you can look it up. It's Penny Sartori, Sartori. Now that's one stream, or fiber one if we're going with the rope analogy. Let's go to stream two. That's terminal lucidity. If consciousness is something the brain produces, then when the brain is destroyed, the person should be gone, not hidden, gone. That's not a caricature of the materialist position. That is the position. So what do we do with the ones that come back? This thing I mentioned, terminal lucidity, a person with advanced dementia or a brain tumor, years past the point of recognizing their own children, hasn't spoken, hasn't recognized anyone in the room, they become fully themselves again. Names, memories, conversations, the old voice. And then, usually within hours or days, they pass. The vast majority of them, when they have this terminal acidity event, pass within a week. And it looks like a miracle. You may have seen this yourselves and thought it was just a private stranger, just your father, just your mother. But I want you to know it has a name and it has literature. There's a story about a young psychology student in the early 2000s. He got a call about his grandmother who had vascular dementia and had barely spoken in a year. She'd suddenly become herself. He called her. She spoke to him in the German she used with him as a child. She recalled shared memories in detail. She told him that he brought joy to their lives, and she passed a few days later. He didn't understand what he witnessed until years later when he came across the research literature. Here's the literature briefly without drowning in the numbers. Go to the article if you'd like to see the numbers. Researchers have collected case after case of this, spanning Alzheimer's, brain tumors, strokes, meningitis, even chronic schizophrenia, going back long before modern medicine, which tells you it's not just an artifact of ICUs and ventilators. The pattern holds up in the largest modern studies too, which surveyed hundreds of nursing and medical staff across multiple countries. The overwhelming majority of these episodes end in complete remission. Memory, orientation, response to speech, all of it. They've been unresponsive or uncommunicative for years. They become communicative, and then shortly after, they pass away. In these cases, brains that were supposedly damaged beyond any possible repair, with no medical explanation for what came back, came back. All these things I talked about earlier. Of course, this does not prove survival. It's not even close. What it shows is something is happening where lucidity returns with no physical explanation that we currently have. Now, there are physical hypotheses, a surge of brain chemistry near death, briefly reopening access to preserved circuits. Now, I'm a layperson, so I don't know how that will work mechanically, but it's genuinely strange in materialist terms. The tissue is damaged or destroyed. The structures that memory is supposed to depend on are physically gone, and the person comes back. Not a fragment, the person, the humor, the way they spoke, the turn of phrase. They say your name, and then they leave. So what can account for this from where I sit? If the brain is operating as a filter, maybe it gets out of the way for a moment as someone is passing. It's that consciousness, which I believe is fully intact the whole time, even as the body fails. It lets that consciousness come through undistorted. That's my hypothesis. If the person is simply what the brain produces and the brain is ruined, somebody needs to explain to me what's doing the producing. But I do have a hypothesis, which I just presented. So that's two streams down, still not a verdict. Let's go to stream three. Let's talk about after-death communication. This one is spontaneous and direct. No medium, no ritual, no device. Nobody sought it out. It just happens. That last part is what separates it from the others. These people weren't investigating anything. Most of them were just doing the dishes, and it's happened to them. Bill and Judy Guggenheim spent years interviewing people across the country, the U.S., and named this field after-death communication. What they found is this, that it's far more common than people assume. Common enough that if you're in a room with 10 people, two of them probably have a story that they've never told you. And I want to interject something personal here. After my daughter passed, we had things happen. Lights coming on, lights flickering, our ceiling fan coming on, my computer and electrical circuits doing strange things. And when I started telling these stories to friends that I've known for more than two decades, they started telling me theirs. And that's the thing. They had these stories, they just weren't sharing them with me. And in my small sample of, say, 12 people that I told, there were five or six of them that told me stories back after I told them. So here's what this stream can do and can't do. Volume is not proof. There are a lot of accounts of something. It's still just accounts of something. And there are the standard explanations on the table. Grief expectation, pattern recognition, a brain under tremendous strain reaching for meaning. And we do reach for meaning. I'm not going to pretend these explanations are stupid or don't have merit. They do. But as an engineer, I do the math in my head when something happens to me. Give you an example. I live in Ohio. The cardinal is our state bird. And some people see a cardinal as a sign. I generally don't. They're pretty common around here. But I've had a couple of signs happen to me that I can't explain. And let me give you one.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the one I kind of smile when I tell this one, because it's when the skeptic in me got called out, because I am skeptical, believe it or not. I was listening to a podcast as I was getting ready to go for my morning walk. And the woman on the podcast said that when she's out in public and she meets someone who says they knew her daughter when she was alive, she takes that as a sign of communication from her daughter. So I said out loud to nobody, "That's not a sign. That's just you running into someone who happened to know your daughter." So I went for my walk that morning, as I always do, the same route I've walked more times than I can count. And as I pass one particular house, the one I pass every day, I probably have passed this house, no exaggeration, 5,000 or 6,000 times at that point, because I make a loop and I pass it 6 times every day. But as I passed it that morning, a woman came out. She walked down her driveway toward me. And I took my earbuds out and I said, "Good morning." She said, "I just wanted to stop you. I see you walk by all the time. My name is Nicole, and my daughter Morgan was in Girl Scouts with your daughter Shayna." I was speechless. She could have come out of that house and said that to me on any morning at all, and I would certainly not have taken it as a sign. But she happened to do it on the exact morning I'd said out loud that this kind of thing wasn't a sign. Now, I thought that was pretty impressive. Now, I've got plenty more like it, but I can't bore you with all of them today. If you ever want to hear them, let me know. But I can't resist. I got to tell you one more quickly. I was looking at my phone one day, and every single podcast cover image on my podcast was normally unique to each episode. It all changed in the same photo of my daughter, Shayna. One of my favorite pictures of her when she was 2 years old. And frankly, I panicked. I thought it had gone out to the world. People were going to think I had lost my mind. Why would I put Shayna's picture on all these podcast episodes? So I checked the actual feed on the hosting platform. It was completely normal there. I looked back at my phone. Still, every cover had changed to her picture. Now, I have no explanation for that one. And frankly, if I hadn't screenshotted it, I wouldn't believe it myself. I still sometimes go back and look at the screenshots. Again, none of this by itself is proof of an afterlife. And I don't know the mechanism. I can't explain to you how these things happen. But I know they're very real to the people who've experienced them. If you want more on this, check out the Guggenheim's book. That was stream 3. Let's move on to stream 4, the children. I want to tell you where this research happens before I tell you what it is, because maybe it matters to you. This is out of the University of Virginia School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry in a division called the Division of Perceptual Studies. It was founded by Ian Stevenson, who chaired psychiatry there, and it's now run by Jim Tucker, a child psychiatrist. So this is not a fringe operation in somebody's garage. It's inside an American medical school, and it's been running for several decades. Here's what they study. Young children, usually starting around 2 or 3 years old, who begin describing a life that isn't theirs. And it's usually an ordinary life, not Cleopatra. It's a shopkeeper, a soldier, somebody's brother. These children give names, places, relationships, and details about how that life that they're describing ended. And the research question is narrow and it's testable. Can the person that the child is describing actually be identified, and do the details match? You may be surprised to learn that they've collected a large number of these cases over decades, and the database keeps growing, and two patterns keep showing up. A large share of these cases involve an unnatural death, what we would call maybe an early death, a violent or an accidental death. And a meaningful minority of these involve a birthmark or birth defect that corresponds to the previous life cause of death. So for example, if someone says that they were shot through the head, they might find a birthmark in the back of their skull, or that they died by a spear, they might find a birthmark on their back where they said they were stabbed by a spear. Now, these are also notably what you might expect if reincarnation works the way that many traditions describe it. Typically, there's a long gap between lives, dozens, if not hundreds of years. But these children are often describing someone who died not long before they were born, which is interesting to me because these, again, a disproportionate number of these cases describe violent or sudden deaths. Most of these cases do come from cultures where reincarnation is an accepted belief, places like India, Sri Lanka, Lebanon, Myanmar, Thailand. And that's a fair observation and could be an objection because people might say, well, these children have been primed to believe in reincarnation. That's why they're recounting these stories. But maybe children there are just more likely to be believed by their parents, which is why these stories surface at all. This is a real point. It doesn't make the cases go away, but we can't just call this culturally neutral evidence. It does come more often in cultures that believe in reincarnation. I've given you an explanation as to why I think that might be. Again, personal story. We never tell children about reincarnation or living pre-birth. I wasn't really into it at the time. My girls were 4 and 7 years old, and one day they looked at us and they said they remembered being in heaven, choosing us as their parents. Wasn't prompted by us. Believe me, it was not cultural in my house. There's a book called The Boy Who Knew Too Much about a boy who believed he had been Lou Gehrig in a previous life. He had a visceral reaction to certain ball players he said mistreated him. If you saw a picture of him, he would say, I can't stand that guy. Now, but most of these cases do involve people who weren't famous, kids who couldn't have looked them up. There's another case of a boy who described being a fighter pilot shot down in World War II with details about the ship, like real details about the ship's name, and his shipmates and their names. So these kids aren't vaguely saying, I was somebody else or I was a soldier in the war because I saw a World War II movie. They're giving specific names, places, dates, etc. Let's go on to stream 5. Let's talk about mediumship. This is going to be the most controversial stream there is. So I want to talk about some very specific cases, mediumship under blind conditions. And I'll talk about what blind is. But I want to say this clearly up front before we get into it. Cold reading is real. Hot reading is real. Fishing for information is real. These are things that people who claim to be mediums have been doing for probably hundreds of years. I always say that there are bad mediums, there are good mediums, and there are outright frauds. None of that is in dispute. So I don't take this to mean that I'm a fool that believes everybody that says they're a medium. The question that a researcher asks is usually narrower. Under conditions where fraud and cold readings are physically impossible, they know about these objections and they rule them out. So I want to tell you about a particular researcher. Her name is Julie Beischel at the Winbridge Research Center. She's been running this test for years. Now, Julie's training is in pharmacology and toxicology. She comes out of hard lab science, not parapsychology. So here's the setup because it matters. It gets a little complicated, but please bear with me. The medium never meets or speaks to the person receiving the reading. So that rules out them being able to read their body language, their age, whatever. They don't ever meet or speak to that person. The medium is given only a first name of the deceased. This is called the target. So they don't get the last name. No way they could possibly look them up. The person running the session, the researcher interfacing with the medium, doesn't know the details either. That's blinded from the person running the session. And the person receiving the reading, the sitter is called in mediumship, is given 2 readings to score. They're given their own and they're given a decoy. And not, they're not told which is which. So this eliminates sitter bias thinking, oh, I want to, you know, give the medium a good score, for example, because you're given 2 readings to score. Now, if these were just vague, cult-style reading statements that fit anybody, the decoy reading should score just as well as the real one. If the medium's just giving, you know, random statements, they should score the same. They don't score the same. Sitters consistently and meaningfully, statistically meaningfully, rate their own reading higher than the decoy. And they score noticeably better on specific, checkable details. They ask the medium to give physical description, personalities, hobbies, cause of death, etc. Not vague lines like I'm sensing a mother figure. Now, I'm not going to bury you in the exact numbers here. The numbers are there. But the fact that matters is that people recognize their own reading more often than chance would predict on specifics that a stranger with no information should not be able to guess. Now, again, the limitations. The samples are small. I talked earlier, there's not a lot of money for this research. It's painstaking to put it together. These studies are hard to organize and they're expensive to run. The medium used are pre-screened and they're vetted. They are the best of the best. And even the best of them are not even close to 100% accurate. I want to explain that to you. This is not some mediumship is not someone sitting down and having a phone call with the deceased. It's closer to an art that we don't fully understand, and it's not perfectly reliable even in the best cases. So I want to let you know that right up front. On its own, it's certainly not proof, but it leans and it leans consistently towards something real going on. So I'm going to put this out as maybe the weakest of the five, but I can tell you from my own personal experience, having had dozens of medium readings, having been friends with mediums, sitting with them, I believe it is one of the five. And I think the more you research, the more you understand why I believe that. So let's talk about some of the holes in what I presented. With terminal lucidity, we report on the people who had it. We don't talk about the ones that didn't. Not everyone has terminal lucidity. It's actually probably a small percentage of people who are passing from dementia, Alzheimer's, etc. But it's an interesting phenomenon that we really can't explain. With near-death experiences, it's actually a minority of people who report one at all. And these remain small studies because this kind of research doesn't get big funding. So there's also a fair question about research and motivation. If you're studying mediumship, you're probably hoping to show it works. Now, this doesn't make anyone a liar, and it doesn't make the data flawed, but it's worth holding in mind. So I'm going to admit all of that up front, and yes, I am biased toward believing that there is survival after death, but I have done the research, and I tell you there's a lot of research out there. I've narrowed this down, actually, to five streams to keep the episode to a reasonable length. There are actually more. I could give you hours and hours of data and information. Now, I take all this seriously, including the criticisms. Now, we might someday find a mechanism for how the brain produces consciousness. I'm not going to rule that out. All I'm saying is that we haven't. And I'm saying we've got very good models for why consciousness is not produced by the brain that explains things very well and actually can explain the hard problem of consciousness that the materialist can't. So let's get to the verdict of why it matters today. And here's my verdict. Pretty clear. I don't think there's any drama here. I say this after, though, at least 30 years of looking into this and to weighing everything that I just put in front of you and a lot more that won't fit into an hour. I think it's more likely than not that consciousness is not produced by the brain and it does not end when the brain does. And I hold that the way you hold a conclusion, not the way you hold a certainty. If somebody puts better evidence in front of me, I'll move. I've moved before. But I want to tell you what this belief actually changed because it may not be what you think. It didn't make my loss painless. It doesn't shorten my grief. It's not a shortcut through grief. And anyone selling you that hasn't been through it. What it did is it took the terror out. There's a difference between missing someone and being afraid of the universe. And for 30 years, I couldn't tell those two things apart. I was afraid. I am no longer afraid. What changed is how I live now. I stopped organizing my life around avoiding that door that's coming up. I got that energy back. I don't fear death the way I used to. And I'm going to give you a concrete example of how this doesn't erase everything. There's a woman named Dr. Mary Neal. I've been fortunate enough to meet her a couple of times. She had a near-death experience. She's spoken about it publicly for years, so I'm not revealing anything here. While she was on the other side, she was told her son would pass away early. Long story short, about 10 years later, he did. Now, she lived with that certainty for a decade. And when her son passed, she still grieved. I still grieve. You're still going to grieve. We're still human. But what it takes away is the terror that colors so much of that experience. I told you last week that my grandfather gave me a silver dollar minted in 1923. Somewhere along the way, I lost that silver dollar, and I've been trying to find it since. But I can tell you the thing that terrified me at 7 years old wasn't really hell. I know that now. And it wasn't really the dark. It was that a person could be standing in front of you talking and then simply not be anywhere. That people disappear. So here we are almost 60 years later, and I've lost that coin. But I did not lose my grandfather. I know he's still with me. I know I'll see him again. It took me almost 60 years. It took me 5 streams of evidence to form this river. It took me 5 strands to form this rope to be able to say out loud with confidence, I will see my grandfather again. I will see my daughter again. That's it for this week. I'll see you next week. We're going to go from all this theoretical material to something actually practical. How does this actually change the way you live day to day? Have a great week. I'll see you soon. Thank you for spending this time with me on After the Storm. If today's conversation resonated with you, I'd love to continue the journey together. You can find more of my work at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's grief, G-R-I-E-F, the numeral 2, growth.com. Until next week, remember, after the storm is where the healing begins.